This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. Defense Department says the military conducted airstrikes Sunday against what it says were facilities used by Iran-backed militia groups near the border between Iraq and Syria. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby says the militias were using the facilities to launch unmanned aerial vehicle attacks against U.S. troops in Iraq. Kirby says the U.S. military, under the direction of U.S. President Joe Biden, targeted three operational and weapons storage facilities, two in Syria, one in Iraq. He described the airstrikes as defensive, saying that they were launched in response to an ongoing series of attacks by Iran-backed groups targeting U.S. interests in Iraq. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid met in Rome Sunday as their new governments look to turn the page on former President Donald Trump and former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose close alliance aggravated partisan divisions within both countries. Now, with Mr. Trump sidelined in Florida and Netanyahu leading the opposition, President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are focusing on pragmatic diplomacy rather than initiatives that risk fomenting opposition. Pyongyang residents have expressed worry over North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, becoming thinner at recent public activities, state-run television KRT reported. And the footage aired by KRT on Friday, which Reuters cannot independently verify, Pyongyang residents were seen watching a big screen on the street showing a concert which Kim and party officials attended after the meeting of the Workers' Party of Korea. This is VOA News. The UN envoy to the Middle East says shipments of Qatari-funded fuel into the Gaza Strip will resume for the first time since last month's 11-day war between Israel and Gaza's militant Hamas rulers. The move indicates a return to the informal understandings between Israel and Hamas in recent years, in which the Islamic militant group has traded calm for much-needed aid and development projects in the blockaded territory. The UN envoy says the fuel will be delivered to Gaza's sole power plant starting Monday. The Israeli military confirms the deliveries without saying who is paying for that fuel. Mexican authorities say that eight more suspects were arrested for alleged involvement in gun attacks earlier this month that killed 19 people in the northern Mexico border city of Reynosa, nearly all of whom appeared to be innocent bystanders. The arrest brought to 13 the number of people detained over the June 19th attacks that left four gunmen and 15 civilians dead. One alleged gunman was detained after being wounded during the shootings, and four others were arrested midweek. The Tamaulipas State Security Agency said Sunday that eight latest arrests included a Gulf cartel leader identified as Van Alejandro N. or Jorge Avan N., alias La Vaca. Prosecutors have said that the attacker sought to terrorize the population as part of a campaign to take control of Reynosa. At least seven people were killed, more than 50 people injured in an explosion in the Bangladeshi capital late Sunday. The cause of the blast, which occurred on the ground floor of a three-story building on a busy street, was not immediately known. Families of the missing have visited the scene of the Florida condo building collapse. The visit on Sunday took place as rescuers continued digging through the mound of rubble and clinging to hope that someone could still be alive somewhere under the broken concrete and twisted metal. The death toll rose by four people to a total of nine, but almost full days of search and rescue efforts. There were more than 150 people remaining missing in Surfside. No one has been pulled alive from the pile since Thursday, hours after the collapse. Mainstream candidates delivered stinging setbacks to the anti-immigration far-right in regional elections in France. Far-right National Rally Party failed to win control of a region for the first time. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Monday, June the 28th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Security officials in central Somalia said that dozens were killed after militants attacked a small town in Mudug region early yesterday.
That explosion in the early hours of the morning creates havoc and confusion, and then they start firing shots.
Harun Maruf of the VOA Somali service. And Zimbabwe Senate is pushing to lower the minimum age for access to contraception and reproductive health services without parental or adult consent. And the East African Legislative Assembly is threatening to sue the community over continued visa charges of citizens in East Africa.
If the council of the minister are not serious in this matter, we are going to sue the community. And the law are very clear. It is a violation of the treaty, and it is a violation also of the common market protocol.
Kim Guy is a lawmaker from South Sudan. We have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, we go to Somalia, where security officials in the central part of the country say that dozens were killed after militants attacked a small town in Mudug region early Sunday. Local officials told VOA that at least 30 people from both sides were killed, including civilian residents who were caught in the crossfire. But as we have seen in the past attacks, both sides are often quick to claim victory or dispute claims of victory by the other side, which makes it difficult to verify some of the information coming from the areas under attack. For more on how Sunday's attack was carried out and how information warfare is deployed by the militant group, I'm joined by VOA Somali Service Editor Harun Maruf.
Well, Al-Shabaab has been carrying out this kind of attacks. These are markedly distinctive Al-Shabaab attacks. They start with a vehicle filled with explosives called Vibert that's detonated at the target area. And then that explosion in the early hours of the morning creates havoc and confusion. And then they start firing shots from all corners in order to create a deadly situation. This is the modus operandi. This is how they carried out the attack on Kenya military base in Somalia in El Ade in 2016, which left up to 140 soldiers killed. This is how they carried out a number of attacks against the African Union forces and Somali forces throughout South Central Somalia.
Okay. Now, both sides have always aimed some sort of victory after these attacks. And in this case, the regional minister of information was vague, a little vague on the details of the attack, instead saying that hundreds of militants, quote, have, many of them have not returned alive. How are both sides, especially the government side, controlling this kind of information related to the conflict?
Well, both sides are trying to control the type of information. They want to be strategic. The Somali government do have a number of media outlets, television, radio, and very strong social media presence. They also have their own journalists embedded with the government soldiers. But the area that the attack took place today is very remote. I doubt there were any journalists embedded with the regional forces there. So what they have been doing, Al-Shabaab as well as the government, is to put out the story as well, as early as possible so that they can frame themselves as the most reliable source or side on the ground. Al-Shabaab do have their own very sophisticated media websites, social media, as well as so-called journalists who travel with the militants so that they record their attacks. And these are the videos and the images they eventually use either to display the effect and the deadliness of their attacks, as well as to attract more recruits. So both sides have been using media in order to really frame the message that's coming out from the area that the attack took place. And because of the lack of presence and the impossibility for any independent journalists to go to these remote areas, the only other independent information comes from citizen journalists and also local elders and local community leaders. But often this is very difficult because either Al-Shabaab turns off the communication networks. Often it's Al-Shabaab that turns off the communication network. So it's very difficult sometimes to verify what's fact from what is false and propaganda. So this media war has been taking place for a long time in Somalia, where the international media and the independent media are so far away from the front lines where the action is taking place, and each side is trying to frame the message and trying to influence the international opinion.
That was VOA Somali Service Editor Haroon Maruf. As Uganda grapples with what some say is the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, entrepreneurs in the country are complaining that the new lockdown imposed to curtail the spread of COVID-19 is having a high toll on their businesses. One analyst says that the lockdown could have negative consequences on the macro economy unless the government intervenes. Reporter Mugume Davis Erguakarinji has more from Kampala.
On a normal working day, Kabalagala, a Kampala suburb, is a beehive of activities, but not today. Only a handful of shops are open after the government imposed a new lockdown in an effort to curb the new wave of COVID-19 in the country.
I'm selling these days like 300 liters instead of 600 I used to sell. 200, it has declined due to this pandemic. People are at home, they are not buying anything. So people are suffering, really. We have suffered.
Father of four, George Kakunguru, deals in dairy products. He says sales have dropped by a whopping 50% since the new lockdown was imposed. Kakunguru says he now cannot afford basic necessities such as electricity bills and a balanced diet for his family. Mother of two, Claire Mirembe, who deals in clothes, says he walks miles each day to work but usually earns nothing by the end of the day.
Because you can come here and sit and get nothing out of it. Yeah, we've come some days, especially at the start of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you come here and sit, probably. No one comes to buy. Yeah. So you just go back, walk home, and there is nothing to eat at home, and your kids just look at you like, yeah.
Another challenge for Mirembe, she says, is that she cannot access new stock since supply shops are also closed. The two say they are now worried, not only for their families, but because they may not be able to pay rent for their shops. Jenny Nalunga, the director of Southern and East African Trade Information and Negotiation Institute, OCATINI, a non-government organization that works to promote trade, says the new lockdown will have adverse effects on the economy.
Some businesses hadn't yet recovered from the first lockdown, and some of the businesses had received loans. Others, from various sources, they had got loans to resuscitate their businesses. So now they are in real trouble. It should also be noted that the cost of living has gone up, cost of services, especially the medical, has gone up. So most people are just eating their capital.
Nalunga says the government should help business people by availing them with affordable loans when the lockdown ends. With more than 1,200 people presently admitted in various private and public hospitals, this past Friday, the government dedicated the country to national prayers. Uganda's President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, quoting the New Testament's book of Luke, justified the lockdown. He said it is meant to ensure people are adhering to social distance.
The lepers who came and met Jesus and shouted to Jesus, said, "Master, have mercy on us." It is in the Bible how you avoid sickness. They stood far and shouted because that society, although they didn't have the medicine for leprosy, they knew how to avoid it.
The government recently announced they will wire some financial assistance to the very vulnerable people using mobile phones. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Zimbabwe Senate is pushing to lower the minimum age for access to contraception and reproductive health services without parental or adult consent. Adi Gondo gives us more on this story.
Following recommendation from the advocacy core team and the Parliamentary Committee on Health and Childcare, the Senate Committee on HIV/AIDS wants to drop the age limit from 18 to 12, noting that consensual sex between age 12 and 16 is not penalized. Civil society organizations working with adolescent girls and young women say they are vulnerable to pregnancy, unsafe abortions, and sexually transmitted diseases. The Senate recommendations have sparked heated debate that reflects cultural and religious biases. Sinatra Nyati, the regional manager for the National AIDS Council, calls for a different approach to dealing with at-risk adolescents.
Giving them contraceptives, I don't think we are solving any situation. What we need is to protect the girl child. I also believe that in this generation, contraceptives are available both in the public and also in the private. So if really a girl child needs contraceptives, they know where to get them. What we also need to do is maybe to have youth-friendly services where a girl child who really need contraceptives should go to those youth-friendly services and access the services. But I don't think that even if you are going to give them contraceptives, there won't be unplanned pregnancies, and also that there won't be any abortions and STIs.
Nyati believes the issue requires a more multi-pronged approach encompassing religious and cultural institutions rather than a one-size-fits-all.
What is critical for me is let's educate our community, and also let's talk about the good morals in our community where we need to protect the girl child. Because if you are saying we're going to give them contraceptives, the girl child, they come in different categories. Some have not started indulging sex, which is a majority of those girls. So what are we saying if you're going to give them contraceptives for those that have not started? As we talk about this subject, let's be mindful that the girl child is not homogeneous.
Some civic organizations point to figures showing about 7% of females ages 15 to 24 have AIDS, and that one in every six teenagers, representing 17%, have given birth. AIDS advocate Taura Nyondo believes the measure is not necessarily the solution.
It also becomes important that we come up with a very clear program to address issues of utilization and uptake. But also, you know, we need evidence to demonstrate that you know, if we are to increase access to even children as young as 18 years, is it going to have the rates of teenage pregnancies?
If we were dealing with the age of consent, our informed view says we actually need to raise it from 16 to 18, because it is our appreciation that our young people must delay as much as possible to be involved in sexual activities. Instead, they must be given enough space and time to be kids.
The debate is set to continue raging in a country where traditional cultural and religious values still hold sway. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The East African Legislative Assembly is threatening to sue the community over continued visa charges of citizens in East Africa. The Assembly says that visa charges are a violation of the treaty establishing the East African Community. Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha.
Kalule Santo is one of the businesswomen in South Sudan. The country joined the East African Community in 2016 and had signed the Common Market Protocol that allows free movement of goods and persons. Kakule says that visa charges raised the cost of doing business in between Uganda and South Sudan.
If you want to go to Uganda, like you go and purchase your goods and come back, you want to take another trip, the first thing that comes to your mind is the visa at the border. The situation in the country right now, it does not favor everyone. Most of us are really suffering, and to get that $50 is not an easy thing.
Article 7 of the treaty establishing the East African Community indicates that the principal objective is the establishment of the export-oriented economy for the partner states, in which there shall be free movement of goods, persons, labor, services, capital, Information and Technology. Kim Guy is a lawmaker from South Sudan.
Same now, South Sudan, who are coming in Uganda and Kenya. Come, I started. One person are coming with like five family or six family. They charge him $300. So this is issue that we cannot move like that in our community. Therefore, we agree that if the council of the minister are not serious in this matter, we are going to sue the community, and the law are very clear. It is a violation of the treaty, and it is a violation also for the common market protocol.
Despite the chairman of the Heads of State Summit, President Uhuru Kenyatta, promising on reciprocity to waive visa charges on the South Sudanese, who are the only nationals in East Africa to be charged for visa, nothing has been done to date. Fred Mukasambide is a lawmaker from Uganda.
I think going to court will solve much in such a way that we shall interpret all of the substantive documents that are arranged in tandem with the treaty as whether or not they reflect the Article 5 of the treaty that creates the objective reasons that made it a logical necessity now for the six countries to cooperate.
Article 5 of the treaty stipulates that the objectives of the community aimed at widening and deepening cooperation among the partner states, that includes common market protocol that allows the free movement of goods and people. Rwanda, Burundi and Tanzania are the only countries that don't charge visa fees for South Sudan, while South Sudan charges Burundi, Kenya and Uganda, while work permit fees are still charged on the reciprocity basis. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
The Kenyan government, in collaboration with UNICEF and other partners, has begun a 10-day rollout of measles and rubella vaccination campaign in 22 counties that were identified as high-risk areas at a cost of $8 million. The campaign follows a measles outbreak reported in some parts of the country early this month. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
Measles is a viral disease and a common cause of death among children under 5 years. Despite the availability of a safe and effective vaccine, the virus has been reported in some parts of Kenya following a risk assessment that was conducted in the country with the support of the World Health Organization in June, following a massive increase in susceptible cases from 648,000 in 2017 to 2.1 million in 2020. The Health Ministry cautions against a looming measles outbreak if action is not taken soon. Dr. Ross Jalango is an immunization officer in Kenya.
So basically means that more children, there are more counties that are reporting outbreaks, and the 2 million children that we talked about are actually at risk of getting measles rubella disease. So in 2021, if we don't do anything, we are actually sitting on a disaster.
Speaking from Nairobi late last week during the vaccination campaign launch, Chief Administrative Secretary for Health, Dr. Mercy Mwangangi, appealed to the government to mobilize resources to support immunization services at all levels and also sensitize their respective communities to go for the vaccination. World Health Organization representative to Kenya, Dr. Rudy Eggers, said that despite the good progress made so far, Kenya has continued to experience measles outbreaks since the last nationwide measles rubella vaccination in 2016. He added that no child should suffer from measles while there is an effective vaccine.
Vaccination against measles will protect children from this debilitating disease, which is one of the leading causes of death among children less than 5 years old.
According to the government's schedule, the measles vaccination campaign will run for 10 days to June 5th and targets to reach about 3.5 million children aged between 9 months to 5 years in the 22 identified high-risk counties. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
And let's go to the Gambia, where the mayor of Banjul has been sued alongside the country's election commission and Gambia's attorney general and minister of justice after being accused of issuing attestation documentation for voter cards applicants ahead of the country's December 4th, 2021 elections. The lawsuit has been filed before the High Court in Banjul by Gambia's civil society organizations. Reporter Pandey Mbai has been following this story and files his report from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The lawsuit was filed by Gambia's civil society organizations, the Center for Research and Policy Development, Gambia Participates, and Abdul Aziz Gay, a local councillor for the city of Banjul. The plaintiffs argue that it is unlawful for the Banjul mayor to issue attestations for the residents of Banjul to obtain voters' cards while citing the Election Act, which they said has been violated by the mayor and the Independent Electoral Commission, IEC. Sally Utal is the president of the Gambia Bar Association.
I personally believe that based on the law, the mayor doesn't have the power to give attestation for the purpose of voter registration. Neither does the IEC have the power to give that power to the mayor. And when this happened, our civil society raised with the IEC from the onset, but they ignored us and rely on Section 127, which they think they say purportedly gives them the power to do that.
The mayor, Rohim Malik Lo, was authorized by the IEC to attest voters. The IEC has also defended the move, saying that there is nothing illegal for the mayor to attest voters.
So for me, it's a rule of law issue because the law governs. We live in a democracy and every action, every state institution, the action must be in line with the law. And the law is very clear. It says an alcalde and a chief. It did not say mayor. It excludes mayor. So I cannot understand for the life of me what is the basis of the mayor granting attestation when the law clearly states who can do it. And for me, my biggest disappointment is that IEC, being an independent institution established by the Constitution.
The plaintiffs are now asking the court to issue a declaration that the actions of the mayor and the IEC are in total contravention of the Election Act. They are also asking the court to issue an order coercing the decision of the IEC to bestow upon the mayor of Banjul the power and authority to issue attestations to the consequence of Banjul. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
And as we come to the end of our show, let's head to Abuja, where Samson Omari brings us the latest in sports on the continent. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sport with the CAF Confederations Cup as JS Kabylie booked their spot in the final of the 2020-2021 CAF Confederations Cup with a 3-0 win to qualify 5-1 on aggregate over Cameroon champions Cotton Sport at the Stade du 5 Julien 1962 in Algiers on Sunday evening. The Algerians made light work of their opponents over two legs and victory on home soil secured a fourth win over Cotton Sport for the Canaries in this season's competition alone, having beaten the Cameroonian outfit home and away in the group stages. In the other semi-finals, Raja Casablanca of Morocco beat Pyramids FC of Egypt 5-4 on penalties after the first leg ended in a goalless draw to book their spot in the 2020-2021 CAF Confederations Cup final at the Stade Mohammed V on Sunday evening. JS Kabylie will face Raja Casablanca in this season's final in Cotonou, Benin Republic on the 10th of July. In the CAF Champions League, record 9-time winners and Egyptian giants Al Hakli will square up against South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs in the final of the CAF Champions League after they defeated Osporons to Tunis 3-0 and 4-0 on aggregate at the Al Salam Stadium in Cairo on Saturday night. Pitso Matsumane, the South African coach of Al Hakli, says they are still one win away from defending their title.
I'm happy if we can give the title, the 10th title to Ali. I'll be very, very happy to do that. And it's an honor for me. But we should keep our feet on the ground. We haven't won the Champions League. We are one step, only last step to win it. And I hope we focus, we concentrate, and inshallah God will help us, we win it.
For Kaizer Chiefs, they are reaching the CAF Champions League for the very first time in their history after they fought hard to secure a goalless draw to earn for themselves a narrow 1-0 aggregate triumph over Wydad Casablanca in Johannesburg. Arthur Zewani is the interim Kaizer Chiefs coach.
It has always been our dream, you know, since when I was a player, before I became a coach, that we want to win this. And hopefully the men above will give us that strength even in the final. And through all these years, it's been tough. It's never been easy for us, but because We believe that, you know, as long as we love one another, support each other, and be there for one another each and every time, even when chips are down. That's what the team taught us.
This year's finals will be a one-legged fixture set for 17th of July at the Stade Mohammed V in Casablanca. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Monday, June the 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead.